Morning, everyone. We're going to get started with Grand Rounds this morning. First, before I introduce our speaker, a couple little housekeeping things. For those of us that do have to renew our licenses, we're going to have our yearly domestic violence and prevention of medical errors courses. Domestic violence will be Monday, December 4th, and prevention of medical errors is December 5th on Tuesday. And again, these the prevention of medical errors is a yearly, every time you renew, you have to do that one. The domestic violence, I think, is what, every third renewal or something like that. So if you're up for your license renewal, make sure you attend these so you can get credit for them. Anyways, this morning it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Clore Yagi, who is a professor from Yale. Dr. Yagi received his undergraduate degree from the Johns Hopkins University and his medical school degree from the greatest medical school in the country, University of Maryland. He also got his MPH in chronic disease and epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. He did his residency at the Yale New Haven Hospital, his fellowship training in pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine at Yale, where he currently is a associate professor of medicine. I met Dr. Yagi at the ACP meeting earlier this year and heard him give his excellent talk on sleep disorders. So this is an important topic that we all see every day. So it's my pleasure to welcome him.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rubin. It's a pleasure to be here today, and thank you for the invitation. So we're going to focus today on the relationship between sleep disorders and, in particular, sleep apnea and cardiovascular risk. But as a sleep medicine specialist interested in things that contribute to hypersomnia and excessive daytime sleepiness, I thought I would start with this study that was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal entitled The Incidence and Risk Factors for Nodding Off at Scientific Sessions by the Nodding at Presentations, the NAP investigators. And in true epidemiologic fashion in this study, they actually characterized various risk factors for nodding off during scientific sessions. There were environmental factors that did not achieve statistical significance. Poor slides were significant. Circadian factors were at risk for early in the morning. My favorite were the speaker-related factors. Apparently, if the speaker wears a tweed jacket, it doubles the risk that the audience is going to fall asleep during the presentation. So what we're going to do this morning is talk about evidence, mechanisms, and strategies. We're going to talk about some of the evidence linking sleep apnea to cardiovascular risk, some of the mechanisms that are at play mediating that risk, and finally talk about some of the strategies that have been used to examine whether treating sleep-disordered breathing actually helps to attenuate cardiovascular risk. So the way that we diagnose sleep apnea, as I think all of us know, is through standard polysomnography. And on polysomnography, we actually measure a variety of different physiologic variables. So we use EEG, EOG, electrooculogram, EMG, electromyogram, to tell us when a patient is asleep, when they're being woken up out of sleep, and what stage of sleep patients are in. The EKG gives us information, obviously, about cardiac rate and rhythm abnormalities. Valid measures of airflow that tell us when there's a complete cessation of breathing, termed an apnea, or a partial airflow cessation, a hypopnea. And other physiologic channels that give us information about respiratory effort, arterial oxygen saturation, and leg movements that occur during sleep. And when we do sleep studies on normal adults, what we tend to see is a cycle throughout the night, cycling in and out of non-REM sleep, which is divided into three stages, and REM sleep. And we cycle into REM sleep every 90 to 120 minutes. So non-REM sleep is divided into three stages. We have most of our deeper stage three, more restorative sleep during the first half of the night, and most of our REM sleep tends to occur during the last third of the night. And it turns out that the physiology of sleep is very different from the physiology of wakefulness. And the physiology of non-REM sleep is very different from the physiology of REM sleep. So in non-REM sleep, we spend about 80% of our total sleep time, and sympathetic nervous activity actually decreases during non-REM sleep. So both heart rate and blood pressure go through this sort of nocturnal dipping pattern in non-REM sleep. There are decreases in cerebral blood flow during non-REM sleep. And as we go from lighter stages of non-REM sleep to deeper stages of non-REM sleep, there are progressive decreases in muscle tone and minute ventilation. In contrast, REM sleep, in which we spend about 20% of our total sleep time, sympathetic nerve activity is similar to wakefulness. So heart rate and blood pressure are actually elevated to the level of wakefulness. There are increases in cerebral blood flow. The breathing pattern is decidedly irregular during REM sleep and entirely dependent on the diaphragm. So during REM sleep, we actually lose all muscle tone in the body, with the exception of some of the ocular muscles and the diaphragm to help support breathing. So our patients with underlying pulmonary disease, for example, can profoundly hypoventilate during this stage of sleep because they lose some of their accessory muscles of respiration with the breathing dependent on the diaphragm. So it's this progressive decrease in muscle tone in non-REM sleep and complete absence in muscle tone during REM sleep that really sets the stage for sleep apnea. We define an apnea as complete cessation of airflow for at least 10 seconds by convention using a valid measure of breathing, and a hypopnea as a partial airflow obstruction associated with an oxygen desaturation or also an arousal out of sleep. And in sleep medicine, we like to count things. And our main severity criteria for sleep disorder breathing is simply a frequency count of these two respiratory events per hour of total sleep time, termed the apnea-hypopnea index. And so we define mild sleep apnea when there are between 5 and 15 events per hour, moderate when there are between 15 and 30, and severe when there are greater than 30 events per hour. And if we apply these definitions and severity criteria to a population of middle-aged adults, we see that sleep apnea is highly prevalent. And this was a study known as the Wisconsin Cohort Study, published about 15 years ago, and demonstrated that about 24% of men and 9% of women actually met criteria for these definitions. Now, if we add sleepiness, excessive daytime sleepiness, so-called sleep apnea syndrome, to this definition, about 4% of men and 2% of women meet criteria, which is still as prevalent as diabetes and asthma in the adult population. Now, other risk factors in addition to male gender include age, postmenopausal status, hypothyroidism, alcohol, sedating medications all can decrease tone in the muscles of the upper airway. Certain obstructive lesions in the upper airway in children, tonsillar and adenoid hypertrophy is a major risk factor for sleep apnea. There are certain cranial facial structures having a small mandibular size, retronathia or micronathia, can increase the risk for sleep apnea, cause crowding of some of the soft tissue structures in the upper airway. But by far and away, obesity or weight gain is one of the major risk factors for sleep disorder breathing. And as weight gain and obesity continue to rise in prevalence, we're seeing a continuous increase in the prevalence of sleep disorder breathing. And it turns out to be very much related to this upper body obesity, this weight in the gut and in the neck that predisposes to sleep apnea. And we think about the pathogenesis of sleep apnea very simplistically. It's really an issue of a balance of forces that are at play on the upper airway. And so lined up on the side of forces that are promoting collapse of the upper airway and the development of apnea is the negative pressure on inspiration and extraluminal positive pressure on the airway imposed by fat deposition, adipose deposition, which causes some of these soft tissue structures to enlarge and predispose the upper airway to closing off. Again, small mandibular size can also do this, promote crowding of the structures of the upper airway. And opposing these forces that are promoting upper airway collapse are forces that are trying to maintain patency of the upper airway during sleep. And the major player here is the genioglossus muscle, one of the pharyngeal dilator muscles of the upper airway. And when those forces that are actually causing the upper airway to collapse override forces that are trying to maintain patency, we have the development of sleep apnea. So some of the common symptoms that I think we're all aware of with this disorder: loud, what we refer to in sleep medicine as industrial strength snoring during the night, symptoms of excessive daytime sleepiness, morning headaches, which we believe are related to cerebral blood vessel vasodilation from hypercapnia over the night. There are a cadre of neuropsychiatric and cognitive symptoms, mood disorders, depression, anxiety are more prevalent among these patients. Memory and concentration is impaired. Often having a bed partner state that my partner stops breathing in their sleep is a very sensitive and specific risk factor for sleep apnea. And this is what we see on sleep studies among patients who have sleep apnea. So these are some of the various channels that we talked about in polysomnography. Eye movements, EEG, EKG, measures of airflow, chest and abdominal effort, and oxygen saturation. And this is a compressed time scale of about 2 minutes. And what we see here are two discrete obstructive respiratory events, each associated with an awakening, what we call a microarousal out of sleep, and an oxygen desaturation. So what we tend to see among patients with sleep apnea is this cycle of abnormal physiology that is occurring throughout the night. With upper airway obstruction and the development of apnea or hypopnea, there is hypoxia of varying severity and duration. With the awakening out of sleep, there's a heightened sympathetic activity, a sort of a surge of adrenaline with increases in blood pressure and heart rate. With resumption of sleep, there is resumption of ventilation, and this cycle occurs over and over throughout the night. Now, there also appears to be a carryover phenomenon into the daytime among these patients with sleep apnea. This is, again, data from the Wisconsin cohort study demonstrating that increasing severity of sleep apnea, as measured by this apnea-hypopnea index, is associated with an increasing risk for going on to develop daytime diurnal systemic hypertension, even after adjustment for potential confounding risk factors, including age, gender, BMI, baseline presence of hypertension. When studies began to explore the relationship beyond hypertension between cardiovascular risk and sleep apnea, most of the early studies were smaller studies, with the exception of this study, which is known as the Sleep Heart Health Study, which was a longitudinal cohort. These are some of the early cross-sectional results of that national cohort study. And this study was demonstrated that sleep apnea was associated with a higher risk of stroke among patients with sleep disorder breathing and an increasing risk of cardiovascular disease. Indeed, with increasing severity of sleep apnea as measured by this apnea-hypopnea index, there was a dose-response effect with increasing risk for going on or for prevalent stroke and cardiovascular disease, again, even after adjustment for confounding risk factors. But After those cross-sectional studies, I think one of the questions that was in the literature is this sort of classic chicken or egg kind of question. Is it the sleep apnea that is contributing to this heightened risk of cardiovascular disease, or is it something about maybe the stroke or the cardiovascular outcome that is predisposing to the development of sleep apnea? And of course, there's this issue of confounding. We just talked about how obesity is a major risk factor for obstructive sleep apnea. And of course, obesity carries with it the triad of other cardiovascular risk factors, hypertension, diabetes, hyperlipidemia. And so these heightened rates of adverse cardiovascular health outcomes among patients with sleep apnea may simply be mediated through this higher prevalence of traditional cardiovascular risk factors. We did a study at our center, the Yale Centers for Sleep Medicine, a number of years ago to try to get at some of these questions. And we tried to answer this question by doing an observational cohort study to get at this sort of temporal relationship. And so we enrolled patients in this study who had not had a previous stroke or a previous MI. They then underwent a sleep study. And now we know whether they have sleep apnea or not. And then they were then followed forward over time for the development of a number of cardiovascular risk factors. And what we observed in this study was that those patients who had sleep apnea were at significantly higher risk for going on to develop a TIA, a stroke, or dying over time. And again, we observed this sort of dose-response relationship. Increasing severity of sleep apnea was associated with an increasing risk for going on to develop this composite cerebrovascular event. And even after we adjusted for confounding cardiovascular risk factors, diabetes, hypertension, smoking, we still observed about a twofold higher risk of stroke, TIA stroke or mortality among patients who had obstructive sleep apnea. And over the last 10 years, there have now been a number of prospective observational studies demonstrating that sleep apnea is independently associated with a heightened risk of myocardial infarction, congestive heart failure, fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular events, sudden nocturnal cardiac arrest, and even all-cause mortality. And these independent associations that are observed among patients with sleep apnea implies that there are some mechanisms that are specific to patients with sleep disorder breathing that may be conferring this heightened risk. And these mechanisms, we believe, really arise out of this sort of abnormal physiologic cycle. We're going to talk a little bit about each of these mechanisms, sort of the mechanical load that is imposed on the airway of these patients, the role of intermittent hypoxia, the sympathetic, heightened sympathetic, nocturnal sympathetic activity, and impairments in sleep architecture. Each may play a role in mediating some of this cardiovascular risk. So in terms of the mechanical load that patients with sleep apnea are under, what this figure shows is the impact of an obstructive respiratory event and what we call the Mueller maneuver, which is trying to inspire against an obstructed upper airway, a closed glottis. And that results in the generation of very large negative intrathoracic pressure. And this gradient between intrathoracic pressure and intraventricular pressure is transmural pressure, or afterload. So associated with each of these obstructive respiratory events are increases in afterload that are seen by the heart and corresponding decreases in cardiac output over and over throughout the night. What we also see among patients with sleep apnea is as illustrated in this 20 nocturnal oximetry tracing are repetitive episodes of hypoxia and reoxygenation that are occurring throughout the night. And this confers an oxidative stress on the vascular bed and likely activates vascular inflammatory pathways that lead ultimately to endothelial dysfunction and increase the risk for the development of atherosclerosis. Patients with sleep apnea, as illustrated in this figure, throughout the night have these sort of repetitive episodes of hypoxia and reoxygenation, these more sustained oxygen desaturations that are occurring at these sort of regular intervals or when the patient's in REM sleep and hypoventilates during REM sleep. So another mechanism at play is this heightened sympathetic nervous activation that occurs among patients, and I think is well illustrated by this figure. And so these are, again, some of the normal physiologic channels that we measure in sleep studies among patients with sleep apnea. But these investigators also measured directly sympathetic nerve activity through a tungsten electrode in the perineal nerve and had a continuous measure of blood pressure through an arterial line throughout the night. And what we see in patients with sleep apnea is that the termination of an obstructive respiratory event are increases in heart rate, sort of spikes in sympathetic nerve activity, and a surge in blood pressure of up to 30 or 40 millimeters of mercury with each of these obstructive respiratory events. Now, normally, as we were talking about, what we tend to see, if we did 24-hour blood pressure measurements on normal, healthy adults, what we would typically see is this nocturnal dipping pattern in blood pressure. And this is not the case among patients who have obstructive sleep apnea. So this figure shows both systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure over a 24-hour period. And those patients in red who have sleep apnea tend not to have this dipping pattern in blood pressure, termed non-dippers, which itself has been independently linked to heightened cardiovascular risk. Now, one of the interesting things that this normal rise in blood pressure, both in diastolic and systolic blood pressure that occurs from 6 in the morning to 12 noon, turns out to be the peak circadian incidence of a variety of different cardiovascular events. So ischemic strokes, sudden cardiac deaths, myocardial ischemic episodes, myocardial infarctions tend to have their peak circadian occurrence between 6 in the morning and 12 noon during this sort of rise in blood pressure that is occurring. This turns out to be inverted among patients with obstructive sleep apnea. And so what this histogram shows are patients with from the general population and patients known not to have sleep apnea in gray and in blue, and patients with sleep apnea in white. And so patients from the general population without sleep apnea, again, tend to have their peak occurrence, in this case of sudden death, between 6 in the morning and 12 noon. In contrast, patients with sleep apnea tend to have their peak occurrence of sudden cardiac death between midnight and 6 a.m. during the sleeping time, during the time when this nocturnal sympathetic activation and hypoxemia are at play. Now, a fourth mechanism that may be linked between sleep apnea and this heightened risk of cardiovascular events is some of the metabolic dysregulation that is occurring in impaired sleep. And we know from studies originally done about 10 years ago at the University of Chicago that restricted sleep, so sleeping less than 4 hours a night, has a significant impact on metabolic risk. So this short sleep duration, these were studies done among normal, healthy college-age students who did not have significant medical comorbidity. They restricted their sleep for a week to 4 hours a night and then allowed them to recover their sleep after that week. And they saw very striking alterations in these participants' ability to metabolize glucose and release insulin. These same investigators demonstrated changes in some of the hormones, leptin and ghrelin, that regulate appetite, suggesting an increase in hunger and appetite that occurs with sleep restriction, indicating a potential additional pathway for the development of weight gain. And this short sleep duration also epidemiologically has been linked to a higher risk for going on over time to develop type 2 diabetes. Similarly, the sleep disruption that occurs with sleep apnea has also been linked to these impairments in ability to metabolize glucose and release insulin. And some of our work in epidemiologic work has shown that sleep apnea over about a 4 or 5 year period of time can also heighten the risk for going on to develop type 2 diabetes even after adjustment for known confounding risk factors. And so when we think about some of the mechanisms at play, there are likely direct mechanisms where sleep apnea may lead to heightened risk for cardiovascular events, intermittent hypoxia, some of the mechanical load changes. But there are also mechanisms that are acting through some of these more traditional cardiovascular risk factors. We know sleep apnea can increase the risk for hypertension. We just talked about some of the metabolic risk. Now, interestingly, epidemiologically, sleep apnea has been associated with a greater risk for stroke compared to coronary heart disease. And the Sleep Heart Health Study, the Wisconsin Cohort Study, and our work at the Yale Centers for Sleep Medicine, when we look at differences in risk for coronary heart events versus cerebrovascular events, TIAs and stroke, consistently, we observe a heightened risk for stroke compared to cardiovascular events. And this may in part be mediated by some additional mechanisms that predispose to stroke. And one of those mechanisms is cardiac arrhythmia. One of the other associations between sleep apnea is a heightened risk for nocturnal cardiac arrhythmias, and in particular, atrial fibrillation. There's Rena Mara out of Cleveland Clinic demonstrated about a fourfold increased risk of atrial fibrillation among patients with sleep apnea. And we know, of course, that atrial fibrillation can predispose to embolic stroke through the development of atrial clot. Another mechanism that may confer this heightened risk for stroke is that some of these, some of the mechanical load and pressure swings that are occurring intrathoracically actually have been demonstrated to give rise to a patent foramen ovale. We know that patent foramen ovale, PFOs, can give rise to ischemic strokes by means of paradoxical emboli, and there appears to be an increased prevalence of PFO among patients with sleep apnea, and this has been demonstrated through echo bubble studies demonstrating that sort of transient increased right-sided pressures lead to this shunting phenomenon through these PFOs. So there may be some mechanisms that are specific to stroke that explain this heightened risk of stroke compared to other cardiovascular events among patients with sleep apnea. But ultimately, the question, I think, is, and what we have been focused on for a number of years now, is whether treating sleep disorder breathing, whether this may actually be a modifiable cardiovascular risk factor, and whether treating sleep apnea may help to attenuate cardiovascular risk. Now, our main medical therapy still to this day is CPAP therapy. CPAP, as we know, stands for continuous positive airway pressure. CPAP works and treats sleep apnea by serving as a pneumatic stent or splint to the upper airway. It's pressurizing the upper airway, preventing it from closing during sleep at night. We know that CPAP therapy improves symptoms. It reduces the symptoms of excessive daytime sleepiness. It reduces motor vehicle accidents in patients with sleep apnea. And I'm going to share with you some of the data that we have that has examined the impact of CPAP therapy on cardiovascular risk. One of the first studies that really tried to get at this question was a study by Marin and colleague published in Lancet now about 12 years ago. And this, again, was an observational study, but they examined treatment efficacy in this observational study. And so they had, over the course of this study, very detailed information about whether patients were using or not using CPAP therapy. And what they observed in this study, which was over about a 12-year period of time, is that those patients with severe sleep apnea, indicated in red, had a significant higher risk for going on to develop a number of adverse cardiovascular health outcomes, MI, heart failure, stroke, et cetera. But what they observed is that those patients with sleep apnea, and largely who had severe sleep apnea, who were using CPAP therapy, over the duration of follow-up in this study, this appeared to result in an attenuation of this risk down to the level of those patients who had really mild sleep disorder breathing, just snoring, or control patients without any sleep disorder breathing. Similar observational studies have been observed in looking at the outcome of stroke. This was looking at stroke mortality among patients who had a previous stroke. These investigators observed is that those patients who had obstructive sleep apnea post-stroke were at higher risk for mortality compared to those patients who had sleep apnea post-stroke and who were adhering to CPAP therapy over the course of the study. But the critiques of these observational studies looking at treatment efficacy go like this. Those patients who are adhering with and complying to CPAP therapy may also be adhering with and complying to other medical co-therapy, the sort of healthy user effect. They may be leading healthier lifestyles, getting physical activity, et cetera. And so this benefit that is observed with observational studies may be an overestimate of the benefit conferred by CPAP compared to, say, a randomized controlled trial. And so the randomized controlled trials, the early randomized controlled trials that we have in the field of sleep medicine, largely looked at intermediate cardiovascular risk markers. And the most common intermediate cardiovascular risk marker that has the most prognostic significance is hypertension. And now there have been about 15 or 16 various randomized controlled trials looking at the impact of CPAP on blood pressure. And they've consistently showed a blood pressure reduction associated with CPAP therapy. And what these meta-analyses of these randomized controlled trials have demonstrated that the more severe the sleep apnea, the more robust the blood pressure lowering effect associated with CPAP therapy. And of course, the longer the effective use of CPAP therapy, the more robust the blood pressure lowering effect, sort of analogous to the sort of the dose-response relationships that have been observed in sleep disorder breathing. But a major question has been recently, okay, we see short-term randomized controlled trials demonstrating perhaps some benefit, but what about longer-term randomized controlled trials and actual cardiovascular health outcome event rates? And there are some real challenges to designing these longer-term randomized controlled trials using CPAP therapy. So some of these challenges exist. So many of the mechanistic pathways that we've talked about, there are pharmacologic therapies that actually help attenuate cardiovascular risk. Beta blocker therapy to reduce this sort of nocturnal sympathetic activation. We know statins in particular can reverse some of the inflammation that is conferred by intermittent hypoxia therapy. Another challenge in these randomized controlled trials is treatment adherence with CPAP therapy. We've observed these sort of consistent dose response effects associated with CPAP therapy. But for longer-term studies, this is not a pill. This is a device that patients have to wear every single night, and long-term adherence may actually be an issue and impact the power of these longer-term randomized controlled trials. And it turns out, particularly treating the period of REM sleep during the last third of the night may be particularly important in reducing cardiovascular risk. And there are also, I think, very important issues around the concept of equipoise. And certainly safety considerations to randomizing a patient that you have diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea who may be symptomatic and sleepy and not treating that individual over the longer term, randomizing them to no treatment or to a sham CPAP over the long term with issues of depression, suicide, motor vehicle accidents, et cetera. And finally, there's this issue of the heterogeneity of sleep apnea, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. We've talked about how we sort of our main metric severity of sleep disorder breathing is this apnea hypopnea index, this frequency count of these respiratory events that are occurring throughout the night, and we sort of very basically divide patients into mild, moderate, and severe. But it turns out patients who actually end up having the same apnea hypopnea index can have very different sleep disorder breathing in terms of its impact on hypoxia or sleep architecture, the presence of apneic event versus hypopneic events. And we recently did an observational study at our VA affiliate where we saw various phenotypes that are based on some of these, all these physiologic measures of polysomnographic measures of sleep apnea within these sort of traditional categories of sleep apnea that may actually better explain risk for adverse cardiovascular health outcomes. And importantly, these various phenotypes, and we saw seven different phenotypes based on hypoxia, sleep architecture, sympathetic activity, respond differently to CPAP therapy in terms of how they confer cardiovascular risk. So it's really in this context of some of these challenges that we have some of these more recent, longer-term randomized controlled trials in sleep apnea. One of the first studies was a European study done by a Spanish group published in 2012 in JAMA. And they got around some of these equipoise issues that we were talking about by focusing in on asymptomatic patients. And so they enrolled patients who had sleep apnea, potentially severe sleep apnea, but were not tired, were not impacted in terms of their functioning during the daytime. And they looked at the incidence of hypertension and adverse cardiovascular events over time. And what they observed was sort of a trend to improvement in CPAP therapy. But when they analyzed the data, with respect to whether patients were adhering to their CPAP or not over time, they did see a statistically significant difference. But the primary intention to treat analysis was negative. Similarly, a randomized controlled trial looking at CPAP on the incidence of myocardial infarction, again, among non-sleepy patients because of this equipoise issues, did not see an improvement in or risk reduction, statistically significant risk reduction. But in the secondary analysis, when they looked at the number of hours of use of CPAP therapy, again, they saw this dose-response relationship with longer duration of CPAP use associated with a more robust risk reduction for myocardial infarction. And one of the challenges of doing randomized controlled trials among non-sleepy patients is that this is the hardest group of patients to get to adhere to CPAP therapy. One of the predictors of long-term compliance is that patients feel better when they use the CPAP therapy. And more recently, we have the SAVE trial, which recruited patients with stroke and MI, and again, did not see in the intention to treat analysis statistically significant risk reduction, but with in part because over the longer term, they were only able to get patients to adhere to CPAP therapy to about 3 hours of use per night, which was not enough to confer a risk reduction. When they again looked at adherence and its prediction of risk reduction. They saw a statistically significant risk reduction associated with stroke among patients with sleep disorder breathing. And so we have taken a slightly different tack in our approach to doing randomized controlled trials and have largely focused on CPAP therapy as an acute therapy in the context of an acute stroke. And it turns out patients who've had an acute stroke or TIA are actually ideal candidates for the prevention of recurrent vascular events. There is a heightened recurrent vascular event rate among these patients. At one point, approximately 25% of patients with a TIA will have a completed stroke, an MI, or die within 90 days of that initial TIA event. So new approaches to reduce this recurrent vascular event rate are needed, particularly in the acute post-TIA or post-stroke period. And we think that the treatment of sleep disorder breathing in this context may represent a novel therapeutic target. But there are also some unique challenges to treating patients with an acute stroke with CPAP therapy. We know that patients with stroke and sleep apnea tend to be less sleepy. They have a lower BMI compared to patients who are coming through clinical pathways in our various sleep centers. They have impaired mobility, a lot of competing demands post-stroke, and also cognitive dysfunction, weakness, facial droop, all may play a role in adhering to CPAP therapy. But there's also sort of biologic plausibility to why in the acute stroke period, treating sleep apnea and reducing some of the physiologic perturbations of sleep apnea in this acute post-stroke period may be beneficial. And it has to do with this sort of concept of the ischemic penumbra within the brain. So within an acute stroke, there is a core of injury, and around that zone of ischemic injury is a penumbra which has still viable tissue up to 24, sometimes 48 hours, that is fed by collateral circulation. And so we started by doing a feasibility study looking at whether we could use CPAP therapy in the acute setting, and we recruited patients who had an acute TIA, an acute stroke, to three different hospitals in Connecticut. And what we did is we randomized patients to either usual care after their TIA or stroke or early immediate CPAP therapy without even doing a diagnostic sleep study. So these patients got early immediate auto-titrating CPAP therapy. And what we observed is that we were able to initiate CPAP within 24 to 48 hours in about 75% of patients from symptom onset of having a TIA or stroke. We saw that they were able to use CPAP therapy in this acute setting, similar to patients without stroke. About 50% of our patients used for over 4 hours per night. And in this study was not powered to look at recurrent vascular events, but in our intervention group, we saw a lower prevalence, a lower incidence of recurrent vascular events compared to those patients in the control group. And importantly, all of the patients who had a recurrent vascular event in this study had obstructive sleep apnea. And again, we saw this sort of dose response effect associated with CPAP therapy. Those patients who had good CPAP use had the lowest risk of recurrent vascular events. Those who used it part of the time had an intermediate risk for recurrent vascular events, and those patients who didn't use CPAP at all had the highest risk. In a very similarly designed study among patients with a stroke rather than TIA, we saw very similar results. In our intention to treat analysis, we saw an improvement in stroke severity as measured by the NIH stroke scale among patients with stroke who were randomized to CPAP therapy. And again, we saw a sort of a dose response relationship between the amount of CPAP that they were able to use and their stroke severity over time. Another issue with treating patients with stroke who have sleep apnea is that there may be benefit to recovery from that stroke in the acute setting if we treat the sleep disorder breathing. And this sort of gets to the issue of neuroplasticity and whether this may actually be an important component of a rehab program among patients who had a previous stroke. And we recently completed a study that was funded by the NHLBI called the Sleep Tight Study. And as you can see, we really had to stretch to make this acronym fit, but we stuck with it nonetheless. And what we did in this study, this is what we call not a feasibility study, this was a phase two study. And so we enrolled about 250 patients in this study and used a similar strategy. We enrolled patients who had acute TIA or stroke and randomized them to either usual care or to a diagnosis and treatment strategy to diagnose and treat obstructive sleep apnea. And we measured a variety of intermediate measures of cardiovascular risk at baseline and some measures of stroke recovery and after 1 year of CPAP therapy. We observed in this study that patients who had a stroke had overall moderate severity sleep apnea with the mean AHIs in the high 20s. And we were able to get over this period of time patients to use CPAP on average about 3.5 to 4 hours per night. And interestingly, when we looked at measures of rehab and functional recovery as measured by our modified Rankin scale and stroke severity, we saw differences and improvements in these measures among patients who were actually diagnosed and treated for their sleep apnea. And though this phase two trial was not powered to look at recurrent vascular event rate, we did see a lower recurrent vascular event rate among patients who were diagnosed and treated for their sleep apnea compared to usual controls. And there is now a larger phase three trial that is just starting to look at this very question about recurrent vascular event rate called the Sleep Smart trial. So to summarize, in terms of our discussion about evidence and mechanisms, we've talked about how sleep apnea is independently associated with TIA, stroke, MI, cardiovascular mortality, and even all-cause mortality. We've talked about how the association between sleep apnea and diabetes and hypertension may in fact be on the causal pathway between sleep apnea and cardiovascular disease, but there are also probable specific mechanisms to sleep apnea, including intermittent hypoxia, nocturnal sympathetic activation, mechanical load, and impaired sleep architecture that also may confer a direct risk from sleep disorder breathing. We also talked a little about the heterogeneity of sleep apnea and that AHI may not be our best predictor, that there is significant physiologic heterogeneity, and this has implications for cardiac outcomes and individual patients' responsiveness to CPAP therapy in terms of reducing cardiovascular risk, and multiple sleep-associated stressors that may reflect some distinct pathophysiologic pathways can be measured and may be helpful in better categorizing risk for cardiovascular events in these patients. And finally, we talked about some of the treatment studies. The prospective observational studies suggest that treatment with CPAP attenuates cardiovascular and cerebral vascular risk. Short-term randomized controlled trials looking at intermediate measures of cardiovascular risk have shown benefit, but longer-term randomized controlled trials have not conferred this benefit. And we talked about some of the challenges in doing long-term randomized controlled trials around CPAP adherence, the issue of equipoise, and some of the physiologic heterogeneity of sleep apnea. And finally, we talked about how the treatment of sleep apnea may represent perhaps a novel therapeutic target in the setting of an acute stroke or TIA that may lead to improved patient outcomes. And I'm just going to end with this slide again from the Journal of the Canadian Medical Association that plotted the duration of the lecture by the number of NOLs. A NOL is a nodding off episode per lecture. And as you can see, there's a very complicated relationship, but risk increases over time. So just like to acknowledge some of the co-investigators in this work and some of the funding agencies. And thank you very much for your attention this morning. Do we have time for a few questions? Yes, sir. That's an excellent question. So the question was, it's a challenge sometimes getting patients into a sleep laboratory. There are opportunities to do overnight oximetry to evaluate this patient, and what is the efficacy of just giving supplemental oxygen to patients with sleep apnea? So I think as a field in general, we're actually moving more to ambulatory testing in these patients. And many centers now offer both home sleep apnea testing as well as laboratory-based testing. And home sleep apnea testing is actually a very valid way to screen for sleep apnea among high pretest probability patients. And I think that is helping to get patients who would be unable or reluctant to come into a sleep laboratory. Overnight oximetry is referred to as a type 4 study. It only measures oxygen. The more common home sleep apnea testing that is done are referred to as type 3 devices that, in addition to measuring hypoxia, give us some valid measures of airflow, EKG, et cetera, and improve the validity of that testing. So if we're going to do home sleep apnea testing, I would recommend a device that has been validated to do that. Your question about the use of oxygen is an excellent one. Many of the cardiovascular studies that I alluded to sort of indicated that intermittent hypoxia may be one of the major mechanisms by which this cardiovascular risk is conferred. So it may be beneficial. There was a trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that asked that very question. It compared CPAP therapy to just oxygen therapy with respect to the outcome of blood pressure. And oxygen was not as effective as CPAP therapy in reducing blood pressure. A concern about using just oxygen is that hypoxia is actually a signal that causes us to arouse out of sleep, and by attenuating the hypoxia, it may actually lengthen some of the apneic events. So I don't know that we have a specific answer to that question, other to say that I would recommend using home sleep apnea testing over overnight oximetry in obstructive sleep apnea patients. Among patients with central sleep apnea, which we did not discuss today, which is very strongly associated with congestive heart failure, what we call Chain-Stokes respiration, oxygen is a very effective tool in treating central sleep apnea and improving outcomes. Based on existing literature, I would recommend PAP therapy for obstructive sleep apnea. Good question. Yes, sir. Very good question. So the question has to do with upper airway neurostimulation. I actually sat on the FDA committee that approved this device, and it was fascinating to listen to some of the evidence and some of the pivotal trials. The device that is currently on the market is called Inspire, and it's It's sort of like a pacemaker for obstructive sleep apnea. There's a device that is implanted under a flap in the skin in the chest wall that has a sensing lead that goes to the chest wall to sense inspiration, and a stimulation lead that's fed up into the neck to the genioglossus muscle to stimulate the genioglossus. It turns out is an effective treatment for severe sleep apnea among patients who are not able to use or adhere to CPAP therapy. However, it is only beneficial, they found in this in some of the pivotal studies, among patients who have what's called an anterior-posterior collapse of the upper airway. So with the implantation of this device, before the device is implanted, what's done is what's called a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, where we bring someone into the operating room or into the Bronx suite and actually observe how the upper airway is closing during sleep. If the upper airway is closing in a front-to-back, anterior-posterior, these patients are excellent candidates for this therapy. If it's more of a concentric collapse, this device is less significantly less effective. And it turns out that patients with obesity have more of a concentric collapse. And so this device is not approved for BMIs over 32, which is a significant proportion of patients. But we have used this device, and it can be effective. And the longer-term data that's available now out to 2 years show promise. So it is nice. There are a number of alternatives, treatments to CPAP. Inspire neurostimulation, oral appliance therapy is also very commonly used in patients who are not able to adhere to CPAP therapy.
Good.
Yes. So I'm glad you brought that up. So the more common dental devices are the mandibular advancement devices. And the ones that have been best studied are devices that are customized to the bite of the patient and are titratable. What the studies show that among patients who have more mild to moderate severity sleep apnea, these are actually very effective. They are equivalent to CPAP therapy in reducing symptoms and even hypertension, less effective to CPAP therapy in more severe sleep apnea. But these should be done by a dentist who specializes in this domain, who can follow the patients along with the sleep medicine specialist. Very good. All right. Thank you very much. All right.